address. I'd heard from him and haven't replied to him yet, but it'd be great to catch up because I haven't seen him for many years now.
Good. Oh, I'm glad he's got in touch. And thank you again for talking to me just now. I'm sorry about the first time, but
I'm just going to check now as well because I've never recorded one of these sessions before. I've been using Zoom for many years now.
Okay.
It started really, but I've just it says set to record.
Oh, okay.
All right, it says start recording now. So that's okay. I'm recording it now.
This meeting is being recorded.
It says recording in progress. That's just have it sometime.
Perfect. Yeah. Thanks. I also have a little backup one of these on the
go. Oh, yes. That's a really good idea because I don't know whether it's going to work or not.
Yeah, we'll see.
I mean, funny enough about Ian Kroll, I don't know if I said last time, I think that he, you know, we should have immense gratitude for his contribution to the band on the wall. I mean, it really, obviously Steve Morris was the founder, but Ian Kroll had such a massive influence on what happened in the band on the wall. He was great. I mean, he was a real mover and shaker, I think, you know, in the early days. So I've known him for many years and he was a good friend of mine, but I can't emphasize him enough how much I think Ian deserves plaudits for what he did, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all aghast that 50 years later, it's still there.
Well, it's all because people like him and like people like yourself who keep coming back that it's allowed to have continued for 50 years, really.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I'm going to go over to Manchester sometime and have a look to see what it's like now because my memories of it are very, very different from it is now, I guess, you know. But, I saw it change because there used to be just like a... they built this area at the back, a raised area at the back.
Yeah.
And then there was a balcony and all those things didn't exist, you know, before when we first started.
Mm.
It was just a room, you know, it was a big room with a stage at the end.
Sure.
But, it's very, very important to me, the band on the wall, you know, in terms of my musical memories and my career, really.
So with that said, just we'll have some questions just to make sure that I have got the whole story right, because I want to do you justice and your whole experience with Band on the Wall justice as well. So just to recap, as if I don't know anything about you, please can you tell me who you are and about your career, about where it's gone so far?
Okay, I'm Paul Mitchell Davison, and I'm a guitarist, bassist, and a composer and arranger. And I started my musical career at the age of six. Well, I started before that, obviously, because I learned to play an instrument. But professionally, I started at the age of 16, which is now 62 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Initially in a pop band, you know, which is what we all did, people of my generation. Not hoping for, like, achieving incredible... creativity or something. We were just looking for what happened with the pop music scene at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to put it crudely, fame, fortune and getting laid, you know. And it never worked out that way.
Is that because you moved away from pop?
You are, sorry?
Is that because you moved away from pop?
Well, not particularly, you know. I mean, the fame, I've never been famous. I've been mm-hmm. very well known among the music community. Years I've been in the business, and I've never been rich, never a fortune, you know, but being seemingly well off from time to time with the things that I've done. That's the other thing. It took me a very long time to achieve that, I can tell you. But that's another story. But for me, I was very into what we were doing and what we. It's a very familiar story about pop bands in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
People took them on, managed to go right, and they just got passed aside. And that's what happened with our band, basically. Mm-hmm. I moved back down to London again to try and get something, a more jazzy thing going with the drummer in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen, you know. It was interesting. I mean, that at that age, you're so resilient. I mean, when I went back down to London, I was 17. You're so resilient, you just take whatever comes, and we just persisted whatever. It took menial jobs to help us exist, you know, and it never really happened. So I moved back up north again, and carried on sort of playing with another band. But by that time, I got very interested in playing jazz. That was my main focus, I guess, then, you know, which is not a great career move, because it's like Kenny Wheeler used to say, how do you get a jazz musician to make £1 million? And I said, I don't know, Kenny. He said, give him £2 million, which is about right, you know, because it's never been an area, apart from the very chosen few that have made money out of it or been very rich out of jazz, like Miles Davis and people like that. It's not an area that you're going to get rich on, you know. I mean, but it's one of those things that once you get into it, you can never shake it off, and it's an obsession. You have to do it, regardless of whatever else you're doing to make a living, you know, musically. I mean, you have to play, and that's how I became. I mean, and one of my seminal moments, because we all have these seminal moments in life where something happens and it puts you on a different route, I guess, for a different direction. That's when I was with the pop band, but we were up in Blackpool with the guys who were managing us. And we stayed in the house that they had rented because they were doing a summer season. There were two very famous black American tap dancers called the Clark Brothers.
Okay.
And we stayed in the same house with them for a week or so. And one of the guys who was sharing the house is a guy called Lenny Williams, who was a double bass player.
Mm-hmm.
Playing with I can't remember which band he was with at the time, but he was in the house. He also played the big guitar.
Okay.
And I came back one evening and he was sitting there on the acoustic guitar, which is lying around the house, and playing his beautiful chords, you know. I said, "What's that, Lenny?" Because I'd not played anything like that. And he said, "Oh, let me show you." And he showed me some chords for this song. That changed my life, basically. You know, I mean, I just thought, wow, this is so great. I have to do this, you know, I have to find out about this. That's what changed my whole direction, basically, I suppose, you know, because I was playing like 3-4 chord things and enjoying it, you know.
Yeah.
I loved all that. I still love rock and roll, still love all that music from the 60s and everything.
Yeah.
But it just spoke to me, you know, and Lenny very unwittingly did that for me. I think I told you the story. I met him many, 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 many years later at the Liverpool Philharmonic when I was playing in the orchestra playing mandolin. And I met him at the after show party, and he stopped playing by then because he had a muscular wasting disease, unfortunately. But he came to the party, and I said to him, you know, Lenny, you'll never ever remember who I am because I don't even look the same, because I was just a teenage kid, you know.
Yeah.
Said, you probably remember the Clark Brothers, because he was very good friends with them. I said, do you remember that time when you showed me some chords on the guitar? And he did. And I said, I was going to be a pop star, Lenny, you know. I said, you show me some jazz stuff, you know. I said, you fucking bastard. He thought it was very funny, actually.
Yeah.
You know? But he was a real character. It was Lenny anyway, you know. I mean, I discovered a lot about him later on in my life, you know. But so that's how I started down that particular route. Then I got interested in classical music, and then tinkered with the idea of actually writing music. And I went around the usual route of people of my generation, which was getting into learning how to play instrument properly and reading music, and then getting into dance bands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the what we call dance bands these days, but the sort of bands that play for dancing in ballrooms, you know, that sort of thing, ballroom dance bands, summer seasons in holiday camps, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was great experience. I played in a band called the Valmero Band for 3 years, and that was basically my musical education.
Yeah.
Because I learned so much from playing in that band, you know, managed to hone my reading skills. I started tinkering at the idea of arranging for the band, and this wasn't very successful, but and then I sort of produced a few reasonable arrangements, But I thought, this is great, you know, write some music down and get guys to play it, and it sounds like that. So that started me on another track entirely, you know, the idea of actually writing music, being an arranger, and then eventually a composer. But, and we, all of us did that sort of thing. I mean, eventually, going through various bands, I mean, including a band run by the great guy called Al Wood, who's a legendary figure in the Manchester music scene, okay. In Portsmouth. And I finished up in Manchester in 1970, playing in the Brian Edwards band in the Elizabethan Ballroom at Bellevue. I wasn't very happy there, I'd have to say, you know, and it really wasn't a happy gig for me. And but at the same time, there's a guy called Eric Ferguson, who was a very big name around the Manchester scene as a jazz player, because he played with everybody, you know, all the visiting American artists.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Ferguson, I mean, you know, he's a legendary piano player. I got tired of the sort of bebop thing and wanted to get into sort of a more rocky type of thing. So he got a few young players, including myself, to get us to form this band called Monad.
Okay.
And Monad, very quickly became a bit of a cult following in Manchester, because with the exception of a few other bands like Soft Machine, Paraphernalia, one or two others, particularly outside of mostly London based, there weren't any bands really playing sort of what you call jazz rock.
Yeah.
And so it obviously it was a very big attraction for a lot of people. So we had a residency in the centre of Manchester on Sunday afternoons, which is people were queuing around the block to come and see us, you know, which was crazy.
Where was that?
That was crikey, I can't remember the name of the pub now. It was in the right opposite the Central Court.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember what it's called now. It's near where the Manchester Evening News press offices were as well. I can't remember now exactly what it was called. It's such a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm talking about 1970, 71, mm-hmm. something like that.
Sure.
And this band was so popular, you know, we went from strength to strength. We did some BBC broadcasts, mm-hmm. And we never made an album, unfortunately, but it got to be a big thing. It was the biggest thing in my life, to be honest. I was still doing commercial stuff to sort of, just to support myself, I guess, because those sort of gigs didn't pay a lot of money, you know, but... But Eric again, he was another factor in my musical education, because he was so such a great jazz player, and we became very good, very close friends, you know, as well. But unfortunately, Eric had a lot of health issues, and after about a year of the band, I got the gig with the Maynard Ferguson band to tour America playing bass. And Kenny Shaw played in the band with me. Strangely enough, my first gig with the Maynard Ferguson band was in Manchester, and it was it was called the Duke of York in Swinson. It was a big pub where we used to play an awful lot. You know, I played there with various people, including the Lancashire Jazz Orchestra, one of the first sort of jazz gigs I did in Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And my first gig actually was actually playing with them, but the thing is, Monad was the support band.
Really?
So, yeah, that particular night, I had to play with both bands. So I finished up playing four sets.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The Monad thing, obviously, we'd rehearsed it and rehearsed it, so it was all down, but we knew that. But the Maynard Ferguson thing, I had to sight read the whole pad.
Wow.
Because there was a sound check in the afternoon, and I went up to that absolutely bricking it, as you can imagine. You know, all of a sudden I'd gone from like joining this world famous band, and I thought, well, at least we get to play through a few tunes. You know, they're just what we call tops and tail things. You know, you play a little bit at the beginning, a bit at the end.
Yeah.
And I think they topped and tailed about four tunes, and Maynard said, "Yeah, that's cool, guys. Okay, off you go." So that was it. That was my rehearsal.
Wow.
So when it came to the night, I looked at all this music, and I just had to read it at sight, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
Which was fine. I did a good job of it, I think,
sure.
Because it went down very well, and I got the tour, you know. But and the thing was, Maynard was so impressed with Kenny Sure, the guitar player had a band, and he also asked him to come along on the tour as well. So anyway, I went together, you know, which we did a 3-month tour of America, which is pretty sensational. We played with everybody, including Miles, played opposite Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, you name it, you know, we played opposite them, you know. But so that was my sort of thing in Manchester, and I lived there for 30 years.
So you moved to Manchester in 1970, was it?
Yeah, I was when I first came to Manchester, and I was very involved in the music scene there, which was a fantastic scene. You know, I mean, it was a few years before the band on the wall, but it was an amazing scene. I mean, it really was the place to be, because of course in London was the place to be, but the fact is in Manchester was such a fantastic music scene, and of course you get paid the same amount of money as people did in London.
That's
but it
good.
Was costing about 50% less to live there. So it was a really, really cool place to be. And I loved it. You know, it's such a I mean, it's difficult to describe how vibrant the place was in the 70s and 80s. A fabulous place to be with music, because it was so much happening all the time in so many different places.
Yeah.
And we all got very well paid for what we did, which was fabulous. Mm-hmm. And eventually I got into the studio session scene, initially through Piccadilly Radio, which just started in Manchester in the early 70s. And the senior music producer there was a guy called Pete Johnson, who's been a lifelong friend of mine ever since. And he was a big jazz fan, and as part of one of the things he did, he came out and did location recordings of various bands around the town.
Mm-hmm.
And he came and he heard the band. I forgot to say that the thing with Eric Ferguson was, the sad thing was, he died when he was 41.
Oh, okay.
With a heart attack. So that was the end of the band, basically. But Kenny and I formed another sort of fairly heavy sort of jazz rock band called Work in Progress.
Okay.
A lovely drummer called Nigel Macass, who died. Everybody I'm associated with seems to die, basically. So, but Nigel was only a young drummer, but he was really great. And myself on bass, Kenny on guitar. And eventually we got Munch Manship, who you probably heard of as a big name on the Manchester jazz scene. He was only in his early 20s at the time, who joined us.
Uh-huh.
And he came down to record us one night, and Pete and I hit it off. And of course, his gift was all his recording sessions for radio, you know, and I had a few drinks, and I just said to him, and said, give us a few bloody sessions, you bugger, you know. He still tells this story after all these many years, 50 odd years ago. He said, I'll give you 4 sessions and see how it goes after that. So, you know, I worked with him for over 12 years.
That's great.
And it was a fantastic thing, because it moved out of Piccadilly Radio into Pennine Studios up in Oldham, which is one of the biggest studios, along with sort of Strawberry and other studios, Yellow 2 and all that in Manchester.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody was recording there. So, I mean, I was there all the time. It's my second home. So out of that, I got a lot of other sessions, like doing stuff for people's albums and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a massive move for me, you know. But all this time I was still doing the jazz thing, which is very important to me. It always has been. It's always been my focal point, really, as far as playing music is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Although I played with a lot of orchestras. I played the Halle and Liverpool Philharmonic, BBC Philharmonic, a lot of major orchestras. But you know, because I was into classical music as well at that time.
Mm.
But I guess, you know, I mean, focusing on what we're really talking about, the band on the wall.
Yeah.
Of course, in 1975, when that came along with Steve Morris, who I knew, of course, because we were all doing sort of gigs in the cabaret clubs at the time in Manchester, which was the big business, you know. Blight is one of the bands I'd like, or both of them had like 12, 14, 15-piece bands, which is unbelievable in this day and age, you know, to accompany like really top world famous cabaret artists, which was great, you know, because the bands were pretty good, and we got to work with a lot of very famous people. And of course Steve used to do that sort of thing, so we all knew Steve.
So do you remember when you met Steve?
Sorry,
can you remember when you met Steve?
Of Probably early, probably about mid early 70s, I would think, you know, 73, 70, 72, 73, 73, I would think, something like that, you know. And of course, you know, by the time he got this idea about the band on the wall, we all knew him, you know. And he, I mean, he was a very good musician. He was a very good clarinet player and saxophone player.
Yeah.
But he was also a pretty good businessman too, you know, which is unusual for musicians, yeah. You know. I was talking to somebody the other day about financial planning for musicians. I said, the average musician's financial planning is like, hey, let's just hope for the best, basically.
Yeah.
and when we're older, hope we don't die too late, you know. and that's how it works, you know. So people like me finish up, you know, scratching about, you know, hoping for the best still, you know, like 60 odd years later. But you know, unfortunately, we paid the price for all the fun we've had. But,
there's been a lot of it.
Yeah, most of us are doing okay, but I mean, it's not called financial planning. But so none of us are business people, basically. But Steve was a bit of a businessman as well.
That is useful.
When he opened that place, when he decided to open the place, everybody knew about it. Of course, we all pitched in. So when in the early days, it was like shoving furniture around, you know, setting things up and all that thing. And we loved it, you know. Yeah. And of course, it was an incredible place in the early days because it, I don't know if you know that, because it was connected to the old fish market.
Mm.
It had a 24-hour license.
Yes.
Which meant that anybody could come anytime, day or night, and get a drink.
Wow.
And that persisted actually as well. Then when they bought the place, the license was still in place.
Wow.
I mean, I think the licensing authorities actually sort of took a dim view of it in the end, but it still had a late night license, yeah. You know, in the end. They not only had gigs at night, they had things in the afternoon, they had a community theatre and all sorts of things happening in the afternoon, gigs in the afternoon, mm-hmm. in the early days. And of course, we all ploughed into it. I mean, I think a lot of us just played whatever we could get, you know, just to get the thing going because we thought it's such a great idea.
That's great.
But of course, you know, we're proved right. 50 years later, it's still there, you know, it's amazing.
That's great.
I can't actually quite believe it. I'm sure if Steve was still alive, he'd go, what?
Yeah.
You know, because he died 26 years ago, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Something like that, yeah, 20, because he wasn't around on the 25th anniversary, I know.
No.
But I mean, it's an amazing tribute to Steve. And as I said before, I think Ian Kroll, who was very instrumental in making the place a success.
Mm, yeah.
A lot of other people, of course, you know, names I can't quite remember. But I remember Martin Milner, who was also there at the time with Ian.
Mm.
I'm still in touch with, you know, through Facebook on occasion. But yeah, I mean, those days were so fantastic because we used to meet there. Well, we used to go there to see each other play or see some very famous musicians play. And we'd meet there before our gig, meet there after our gig.
Great.
At the time as well, I had a late night gig, which was from 12 till 2 in the Bigley Radio Studios.
Excellent.
Kenny Shaw and myself used to play a guitar duo live on air.
Excellent.
And so we used to meet in the band at all about 10 o'clock. So we're a little bit the worse for wear by the time we got to the studio. But when we got there as well, we cottoned on, we made good friends with one of the sound engineers. And he said, you play one number and you sit around for ages before you play a number. He said, why don't you just record six numbers, which is usually what you do. He says, one after another.
Uh-huh.
He said, you go and have a break. So Kenny and I, when we got there after we'd been doing it a couple of months, we took him up on this. We slipped him a few quid. And we used to play our first number and then record another five or six numbers, one after another.
Yeah.
Then we go to the curry house around the corner and have something to eat.
Excellent.
And they had a Piccadilly radio on the sound system. And the DJ, who was in another booth but had the curtains closed, says, now over to Kenny and Paul in the studio. I remember sitting there eating our curry and listening to ourselves play.
That's excellent.
I mean, nobody ever knew about that.
No.
Funny, Pete Johnson, about 40 years later, we were doing something together, said, do you know that late night thing? You know, we used to go in there and record it all and go for a curry and wait till the end. And you didn't know about that.
No.
So nobody cottoned onto it. But I mean, they're great days. I mean, all sorts of things like that going on and so much work and so many. So many jazz gigs, so many other types of gigs, obviously, you know. I mean, I think most jazz musicians have always sort of supported themselves or with other types of gigs. And so it should be, you know. I mean, you can't get the sort of money from a jazz gig that you would get going into a studio and doing a 3-hour session.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, I mean, because I used to fix bands and take them into the studio. I remember around 1975, I used to get about £75 for that session,
yeah,
which is about double what most people earned in a week in those days.
Yeah.
And sometimes it was more than once a week, maybe a couple of times a week, or sometimes 3 times a week.
Mm.
So it's a lot of money, you know, it really was. And so you could afford to go and do whatever else you wanted to do.
Hanging out in Band on the Wall.
Going
out and hanging out in Band on the Wall.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, God. I can't think of many hundreds of hours I must have spent.
Me too.
But, I mean, it was a wonderful place to be. I mean, it was the centre. I mean, which I think what Steve intended it to be was going to be the centre of the music industry in Manchester. And it became that.
Yeah.
Everybody knew the Band on the Wall. Everybody went to the Band on the Wall.
Yeah.
And it was just a fabulous place to be. You could meet all your friends there.
Yeah.
Whenever night you went in, you know somebody, you know, a lot of people, and I sat down and had drinks. A lot of very famous musicians in there, played with a lot of very famous musicians.
Like who?
Well, Eddie Lockdell Davis, who was with the Count Basie band, I played with him. Oh, crikey, now you put me on the spot.
Oh,
now.
Sorry.
Sabini Nawaslowski, which you've probably not heard of, but he was a very famous Polish musician.
Okay.
And John Eardley used to play with the Jerry Mulligan's band. Oh, crikey, there's so many. A lot of British musicians, Terry Smith. It's so long ago,
I forgot
most of them, but we're so many we played with, you know.
Yeah.
And of course with local bands as well.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I played a lot with the Resident Trio on bass.
Sure.
With the lovely Dave Roberts, I think I talked to you about before.
Remind me, what was the name of the house trio?
Well, it was initially Dave Roberts on piano.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who was on bass and drums. I mean, I used to play with them quite a bit.
Mm.
But Dave was an amazing character. He was a very good piano player because I worked with him in another club, Dino's Club in Manchester, a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the resident trio there. But Dave was very fond of the old juice, you know.
Okay.
And sometimes he's a bit worse for wear. And which is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes, and he's the only guy I know could eat something, smoke a cigarette, and drink a pie at the same time, and play the piano.
Oh my God! Did he have multiple, like more than two hands?
Yeah. Well, he just used to carry one, drink, and didn't smoke. But one night he was very, very worse to wear on the Band on the Wall, and everybody could see that he was really out of it.
Okay.
And, Balis Novak, who was the Russian jazz pianist who lived in Manchester, who I played with for many years in his trio, was a good friend of mine, was in the Band on the Wall that particular night.
Yeah.
And Dave was struggling like mad, you know. And so Balis sneaked up on the stage, started playing the left hand of the piano, unbeknownst to Dave. And he thought it was hallucinating, you know. And eventually, you know, Balis just sort of eased him off the stool and took over.
Oh, goodness.
So, I mean, Balis was an amazing piano player. I mean, he played for Oscar Peterson once, so I was very impressed with him.
Okay.
So, I had some very, very happy years playing in his trio.
Yeah.
All over the place, really, just some great gigs.
What was he like, Balis Novak?
Well, he was a tall guy who looked like a cartoon Russian, to be honest, you know. And I mean, I remember we played at the Cork Jazz Festival and they sent somebody to meet us at the airport, you know. We got off the plane and Balis got off the plane and walked down the steps with his long trench coat,
uh-huh,
and his big moustache like that, you know, and got to the bottom, and then this little Irish guy came and said, "Hello there, you must be Mr. Balis Novak." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh," he said, "how did he know I was Russian?" Come on, Balis, you know.
Yeah.
You look like a cartoon Russian, you know. That was a memorable gig, actually. We went down a storm in the Cork Jazz Festival.
Oh, really?
I mean, we were there for a couple of days, and I have to say most of it's a complete and utter blur to me. I met a load of guys I used to know playing in the Main Africa's band and
yeah,
other stuff. And as they say in Ireland, drink was taken.
Sure.
Yeah.
Plenty of juice.
But he was a great ballist. I mean, he was a fantastic musician. Mm. But we did some really, really great gigs. And unfortunately, when I first met him, before I met him, he was an alcoholic.
Okay.
I mean, he was drinking a couple of bottles of vodka a day, you know.
Wow, okay.
And but he kicked it. And when we were working together, he never had a drink ever.
Wow.
I mean, I could see him looking longingly at me having a drink, because I've ought to. Euphemistically, I've always been a very enthusiastic drinker,
mm-hmm.
Like most musicians.
Yeah.
Sadly, he had an accident and damaged his left hand. So he'd never play as well again.
Oh dear.
I mean, he was actually doing you remember a group called Real Thing?
No,
they were a big band in the 80s and 70s, 80s.
Okay.
And he finished up as musical director for them. He damaged his hand, and it really affected him, you know, mentally. Mm. He'd never play as well again.
Mm.
And he started drinking again, sadly.
Okay.
I mean, he used to come up to Manchester. He'd get the train up to Manchester from London, where he was living at the time.
Mm.
And he'd just go on a bender in Manchester, and he'd finish up at the Polish club down Chisholm Hill.
Okay.
And I used to get calls from him, you know, this incomprehensible stuff on the phone. I said, is that ballet? He said, yes, man. I said, Rescue me. So I used to go and pick him up, bring him back to my house, fill him full of coffee, sober him up as much as I possibly could.
Yeah.
Then he'd sting me for about 50 quid for his train fare back to London, which I'd never ever see again.
No,
yeah.
No.
And it carried on like that, which is very sad, because he was such a great talent, he really was. And he was just a good friend, so I just tried to look after him whenever I could. But he went back to Lithuania, where he was born, and eventually he died there, you know, mainly from overindulgence in drink. But I could never find out. His mother was a famous classical pianist, Cecilia Aronofsky, and I knew her, and I tried to find out from her what actually happened, but she never let me know. So. But yeah, I mean, he was a bit of a fixture on the scene. Real character.
Yeah,
as were so many of them, you know. My friend Phil Chapman, he was another one, you know, was again big friends with Steve, and
mm-hmm.
we just did whatever we could
to
help it get started. You know, when it got started, it was obviously such an amazing success, even in the early days.
Yeah,
so it was because there was nothing else like it in Manchester at all. You know,
did you see it before it opened?
Was it, sorry?
Did you see the Band on the Wall before it opened? Like it was.
Well, I did, yeah, because I was in there helping Steve, you know, because it was the George and Dragon pub, wasn't it? You know, but I mean, it was just an old Victorian pub, basically.
Sure.
And it was sort of in a bit of a state, really. But I mean, I think they initially, when it opened, what they did was sort of pretty cosmetic, taking wallpaper off and painting the walls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Nothing like it is now. You know. But I think I told you before, they discovered these amazing gilt mirrors underneath the wallpaper, which I think are probably still there today, I would think.
I think
they should be, because they're amazing stuff, you know.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, it was not a wreck, but it was sort of nothing like you would imagine it would be as a venue, you know.
Yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, it's just... As an old person, now it remains very, very much a very fond and positive part of my musical education, if you want, and also a part of my life, you know, because I spent so many hours in the place, both as a sort of listener and a player. So it is an incredible place.
Two questions based on that. One is, You had several bands that played here throughout the time you lived in Manchester. Do you remember their like their names? Like, could you tell me their names so I can make a note of them, please?
I was in a trio called Working. Sorry, I was in a trio called Pause for Thought.
Pause for Thought. Yeah.
Pause for Thought, and that was myself on bass guitar,
mm-hmm.
Kenny Shaw on guitar,
mm-hmm.
electric guitar, and Richard Wright on acoustic guitar, on classical guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And we played at the band quite a few times. Only at Monad, never played there because we'd broken up by the time the place opened.
Oh no.
But it was generally, I think, playing with different rhythm sections with different soloists.
Sure.
I'm just trying to think of, and we had another band, Kenny and I, called Work in Progress, but I don't think we ever played at the band on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
I had a band called Blues and Roots.
Okay.
Which I played several times at the band award, which was a 12-piece band. I played with the contemporary jazz orchestra who played some of my music, and I conducted them.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many, it's very difficult to remember all, really.
If you remember any more, feel free to email me.
It's quite difficult to remember who I played with because it is a long time ago. I mean, it's 30, 40 years ago. I just remember my memory is that I was there a lot playing.
Yeah.
Either with a house band or playing some guests.
Sure.
I think just a fabulous time in my life, really. I mean, and it was all down to the band on the wall. I mean, I think it's not just down to the band on the wall, it's down to the sort of the scene in Manchester at that particular time. It came at just the right time because there was such an amazing thing going on in Manchester at that time, not just in jazz, but with popular music and all sorts of areas of culture, classical music. You know, I mean,
yeah.
Manchester has always had one of the world's leading orchestras, and it was just a very, very vibrant place to be. I mean, it was just buzzing all the time. I think it's the happiest I've ever been, to be honest. Yeah. And that's quite difficult for a musician to say because I'm miserable bastards most of the time. it's just the possibilities were always endless in Manchester, I thought, you know.
Yeah.
And when I left it after 30 years, I guess it was not the same, but it's obviously not the same now. I mean, a few years ago, up in Manchester, I was doing a project with classical musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been to Manchester for years, living out in country towns, you know, all over the place, various places.
Yeah.
And I got caught the train and got off at Piccadilly, and I just stood there in the station and thought, what the fuck's going on? You know, all these people rushing about, doing stuff. And I just stood there and thought, I feel like a country bumpkin, you know. And I used to live here, I used to be part of this big, vibrant scene.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it, and I had a bit of time to spare, so I had something to eat and walked around the city centre a bit, round about Piccadilly Station. I didn't recognise any of it, to be honest. It all changed, particularly the central area around Piccadilly and all that, really, where the bus station used to be and where the Piccadilly Radio Studios used to be in.
Mm.
I just didn't recognise it at all, so I don't feel any connection particularly with Manchester anymore. It's so long since I was there.
Yeah.
I do. Really, I'm so glad that I actually finished up there in 1970. Being my first wife, she was actually from Manchester. That's why one of the reasons we moved back to Manchester, apart from the fact I got a gig there, you know.
Yeah.
But I can't really say how much I valued my connection with the band on the wall. I'd like to reiterate as well again, you know, that Ian Crowell was a real mover and shaker. He is a very, very important person as far as I'm concerned. I'd say Steve Morris and then Ian Crowell.
Yeah.
That's not to devalue anybody else who's ever been part of that, because there are many, many of them, you know.
Mm.
And obviously to keep that place alive and flourishing for 50 years is a no mean feat. And I think anybody who's involved in it deserves a bloody medal, you know. You know what it's like now with music venues closing all over the place.
Yeah.
Even grass music, grassroots music venues, particularly. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't describe the band as a grassroots venue anymore, because it was when it started, but not anymore. It's a major sort of international venue, which everybody's heard of. You know, you say band on, you'd go anywhere in the world and say, band on, oh yeah, yeah, you know, fantastic. I went there and hear somebody play, or I played there, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So it is a very, very important Manchester cultural segment. And I hope it'll still be there long after I've gone, you know.
Yeah, I hope so. I don't want to think about that time, but yes, I hope it is too.
Well, yeah, well, it won't be very long, actually. Don't I can tell you, because it's getting very old. We're all getting, all those guys are very old now, you know. Mm. I mean, some of us, I mean, I'm not, I haven't made it yet, but some of us are in our 80s, you know. I mean, I'm 79 in December, which is pushing 80. But I know most of us are in our late 70s now, or are older, you know. David Lenane, who's inextricably tied up with the band, they're always played there so many times. He'll be 86 this year.
Wow.
So great bass player, and he's still playing well, you know. He's really still playing great.
That Dave Lenane, you say?
Dave Lenane, L-Y-N-A-N-E. Sorry, L-Y-N-A-N-E.
A-N-E, cool.
So and you've obviously, have you spoken to Dave Hassel?
I actually, no, forgive me, but I actually haven't. And I have been meaning to, but
yeah,
time has been limited, really.
He's in hospital at the moment.
Is he?
Yeah, he's having a pacemaker fitted.
Oh my goodness, okay.
That's going to happen this next Monday, and he'll be around for a bit, but you should talk to Dave, because
yeah,
I mean, you know,
he's
another fixture at the band on the wall, you know, from the early days, like myself, because we played there so many times together. And he's a legend in Manchester, is Dave.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dave Hassel.
Yeah.
So Dave Hassel, Dave Lenane, you know, they're sort of two of the big Manchester legends, basically. Great friends of mine, I've known them all for like 50 odd years. We've been playing together for 50 odd years.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, you should talk to, I mean, Dave actually did record an interview, which you can find somewhere, about an hour long, about his connection with Manchester and the band on the wall.
Did, has he?
Yeah, it's there somewhere. I mean, you can find it. It must be there in the archives somewhere.
Yeah.
Ian Crowell was saying to me, he'd also done quite a lot of research on the band on the wall a few years ago.
Mm.
Have you talked to Ian at all?
We've been emailing, and he has shared, so yeah, he has done a lot of the history about the venue, about the building before it became Band on the Wall. I think he's focusing right now on its 20th century history, so I'm really looking forward to reading that. And he sent me a big piece about Band on the Wall as it is now. You were name checked in it, and Dave Hassel was name checked in it, and he just, so there's various people throughout his writing that I've happened to speak to through this project.
You should also talk to Bunchmanship.
Bunchmanship, yeah, I absolutely should.
Because, you know, he's played us so many times.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the people I can mention are no longer with us, sadly, but and of course, like Joe Palin, you know, played them many, many times. And Joe's been dead quite a few years now. A legendary jazz piano player, Joe, you know. I'm just trying to think of other people. I mean, Phil Chapman, of course, he deserves a mention. Phil's been dead quite a few years now, unfortunately. So there were people who were like really around from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Just trying to think of who else. There's so many of them, but so many of them. When you get to my age, there's so many people aren't there anymore, you know. I mean, Vinnie Parker is another one, piano player. Just so many of them. It's inevitable, I guess, you know. And so, I'm just amazed that I'm still here, to be honest.
I'm glad you are.
we didn't exactly enjoy healthy lifestyles, just to say that. I mean, David Lenane is 86 this year. We were talking on the phone a few months ago, and I said, "Bloody hell, man, I'm going to be 79 in December." I said, "You're going to be, you're 85. How the hell do we manage that?" Said, Well, lad, we looked after ourselves, didn't we? It's absolute bollocks, you know.
The amount of alcohol a day is perfectly advisable. You know, it's good.
Well, that's what I always say, and I never been. I, these days, I'm drinking a lot of red wine. That's my thing.
Okay. I can't have too much red wine.
You're sorry?
I can't have too much red wine. It just makes me a bit sleepy.
Or I didn't think there's anything much is too much red wine. But I mean, we all have to dial it back. I couldn't drink the amount that I used to drink in the early days.
No.
But it was fun, you know. You do that, and I guess when you get old, you just have to sort of dial it back a bit and just think. You know, it's if you can hear any rumbling in the background. It's our next door neighbour. We've got I live in a cottage, a row of stone cottages.
Yeah.
Our next door neighbours are Ukrainian refugees.
Oh, okay.
And their eldest son. He's a big heavy metal fan.
Oh, okay.
He's learning to play the bass guitar, but he practices and he plays the same three bloody notes over and over again.
It's crazy.
You know? I mean, the big stone walls, but it comes through the walls, you know.
Yeah.
I sympathize with it for learning an instrument, but I keep thinking, play something different for God's sake, you know. But I mean, you know, East European people are very into heavy metal, a lot of them, you know. But yeah, that seems to be his thing.
Yeah.
He plays the same riff about an hour ago, you know. He was playing earlier on, but he had a break, so he's revitalized now. So it does drive us a bit crazy.
You know? Oh, no.
I mean, on one hand, I feel like going and saying to him, look, you know, come on, look, do this.
Yeah.
He's obviously not getting very good guidance. But I don't really want to encourage him too much.
No. Well, at least he wouldn't have to listen to the same three chords over and over again if you taught him.
Well, it's the same three notes, you know.
Same three notes.
Well, you know, a few variations. But my wife puts Radio 3 on in the radio and sticks it next to the wall. Just to drown it out. But, you know, I don't want to ever dissuade anybody from learning to play an instrument, but it is a bit annoying.
Yeah.
Time to time. I don't know how the family put up with it because it must be very loud in there.
Yeah.
I thought of buying him some headphones and a little sort of little clip-on amplifier. You know, do that he can blow your head off
without
not bother anybody else.
Not your walls. Yeah.
I don't know. You know. I mean, you can't. I mean, they're a lovely family, actually. You know, really nice people. But
the heavy metal.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine what they go through. You know?
No.
I mean, it just seemed totally normal. They've really got into their way of life in this sort of little Yorkshire town. But sitting there looking on the news and seeing your country being blown to pieces, it must be awful. You know.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think that generally the state of the world now is very powerless, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly feels that way.
I think, you know, there's generally a sort of air of anxiety with everybody now.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not something you can actually see or identify, but I think that I can remember because I was only young, I was a child, but remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, where that's the closest we've ever come to a nuclear war, you know, before. And I remember that the way that even as kids we thought, bloody hell, you know, what's going to happen?
Yeah.
And of course, it was teetering on the brink for quite a while until Khrushchev backed down and Kennedy just sort of made him see sense. But it seems to be a bit like that now, really.
Yeah.
Because basically, we've got psychopaths and morons running the world, you know.
We do.
Or either psychopaths, morons, and people who are fairly ineffectual trying to do what they do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Frightening situation.
It is.
Particularly the big orange bag of shit, you know, he frightens the life out of me, to be honest.
Mm.
It really does.
Mm. Yes, me too.
Anyway, you can edit that bit of rubbish.
No, it's okay. It's absolutely true. It's funny that it's not funny, but it's kind of the backdrop while everything else is going on and you're trying to press on and keep enjoying your life. There's all of this happening in the world, and it doesn't feel quite right that we should have such enjoyment.
I mean, if it gets to a really critical stage, I'm just going to go out and buy a very large amount of red wine
and have a big bender.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I can't really do that anymore because, you know, when you get old, the effects of alcohol, lots of alcohol just linger for those days afterwards. You feel like you really should have died of that particular night, you know, because it's so awful because I can't do it anymore. But, yeah, I think that's what I'd do, you know. Unfortunately, I mean, I live in the country, you know. It's in a town, but I live out in the countryside on the edge of North Yorkshire Moors.
Yeah.
In the event of a nuclear holocaust, one of the primary targets would be the Fylingdales Early Warning Station, which is 10 miles exactly from where I live.
Oh dear, okay.
So we're not safe even here.
No, and to be fair, in the event of a full nuclear holocaust, I don't think anywhere is safe.
I don't think so, no. I wouldn't feel
Apologies for
anything,
being
it
to
would be
that.
10 miles away, but
Yeah.
yeah, but it's a bit. I was talking to one of my neighbors. I said, it's great to live in this little country town, isn't it, where it all feels pretty safe. He said, yeah, I said, apart from the events of a nuclear war, which were a primary target,
Yeah.
well, not us particularly, but somewhere down the road, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a lot of aerial activity just recently as well,
Really?
with planes coming over. I think there must be sort of maneuvers and stuff as
Yeah.
well. I hope it won't come to that, but
Yeah, I hope it doesn't.
yeah.
Yeah. Well, back to Band on the Wall, which I hope does not perish anytime soon. I would like to ask you about the Shouting on Swan Street piece, please.
Yeah.
Tell me about how that came about and how did it go, and yeah, tell me everything, please.
Well, it's the 25th anniversary, and Ian Cole and Martin Milner, who was working with Ian at the time, Ian knew of my sort of close association with the place and of my sort of composing and arranging skills, and they both asked me if I'd write this piece, and of course I immediately said yes, because I so felt so honoured to be able to do it, you know.
Yeah.
So I did quite a bit of research into the place, you know, found out the origins of the place and everything, like the Georgian Dragon, originally pub, and how it was a place for GIs in the Second World War and all that sort of thing. I did a lot of research before I did it, and I thought I wanted it to reflect the sort of, because I had this idea. I think, well, I don't know if it's, I think it might be a fanciful idea, but if you take a place which had music in it all the time for many, many, many years, I think it's embedded in the fabric of the building in some way, you know. I don't know. It's just, I don't think that's a fanciful idea,
I
actually. I
don't think
think you're
so.
probably right. You know, I think bloody hell, this place has been here for like, how many years? I don't know, 150
It's
years.
been a
I have no
while.
idea.
So sources I can think kind of contradict. It's either 1802 or it's about 1830, 1850,
Well,
around
actually,
that.
over 200 years, yeah,
Yes.
which some form of music would have been happening in it all the
Yeah,
time,
definitely.
until the band on the wall thing, with the actual band up on the wall and that sort
Yeah.
of thing. But so there's been hundreds of thousands of hours of music performed in it, and I thought, yeah, it's got to be part of the atmosphere and the fabric of the building in some way, you know, really. So I thought, I just wanted to write a piece which reflected that. And I had no idea what I was going to do. And then I thought, well, looking back into some of the research, I knew that Irish music was played there quite a bit. So I started with a piece that reflected sort of Irish music, but it has sort of jazz overtones to it. And it went through like a cycle of things where swing music, all sorts of things, really. I mean, it's a real pastiche of various types of styles of music, all within, I think it was four movements basically. So the first one was called Tales from the Georgian Dragon, which was about all the various styles of music. And then the second one was called Apocalypso, which is sort of like a calypso, but very, you know, contemporary. And then the third one was called Absent Friends, which was dedicated to people who were no longer with us, you know, Richie Close, who had connections with the place, Richie Close, who only died when he was in his early 40s, Nigel Thomas, or Nidge Thomas, bass player, the guy who died quite young, who actually committed suicide, which was terrible.
Oh dear.
Alice Novak, And of course, Steve Morris, you know, it was, and that was, piece was dedicated to them. But it, when it finished up, it's when it finished, it segued into a piece by the gospel choir, mm-hmm. which was part of the outreach things that they started to do then,
mm-hmm.
Was a sort of like a gospely thing with just a rhythm section on the stage. But one of the lines was, I'm just trying to think of the actual words now. Stephen, a small man with a big heart, who brought music to the people. And that was one of the lines that they sang.
Lovely.
And so that was quite emotional. Yeah. And then the fourth movement was called Shouting on Swan Street, which brought all the themes together of the band. And also in the balcony, there was a student, they had the other outreach thing was the jazz improvisational workshop, which they had. Mm-hmm. So the students from that were there up on the balcony, and I included them in it. So it was a bit written for them. So when it got to that stage, the onstage band stopped, and the band in the balcony took over with our rhythm section still ticking away to keep them in time.
That's great.
I mean, it got a little bit out of time here.
Yeah.
It was quite a bit of a distance between them. I think they were very, very nervous, you know.
Yeah.
But it was great because they were involved in it as well. So there were two elements of the outreach, the stuff the band was doing at that time, which was the gospel choir, and with the which were great, the gospel choir, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the jazz workshop students as well, which Chris Williams, who was actually in our band, was organizing that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that was sort of, and then the very finale of it, everybody joined in.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the choir, the student band, and the onstage band doing this like looped sort of thing, which just built and built and built and built and built.
Yeah.
And that was the end of the piece. It lasted a whole hour.
Wow.
And when we got to the end of the piece, I mean, it was very exhausting for me because I was playing the guitar and directing it, and I was playing a bit of mandolin as well,
cool.
But directing the choir and the whole thing. I was absolutely shattered at the end of it. It's just such non-stop, you know, stuff going on. A great band. I mean, I was lucky to get some fantastic musicians. I'll tell you all the names in a minute. But the end of the performance, we finished it, the final chord, and there was a silence. And I thought, oh, shit. And all of a sudden, somebody started cheering. And then we got a standing ovation, which lasted, I don't know, it seemed to me like about 10 minutes.
Wow.
There's people shouting and cheering and cheering and shouting, clapping. But I just stood there and I just didn't know what to do myself. I thought, this has got to be the high point of my life, which I still think it was, actually.
Yeah.
And it was amazing, you know, I just stood there and we all stood up, all the musicians just stood there and just flabbergasted.
Mm.
I mean, I know we'd given them a really good performance, but obviously, you know, something really connected with the audience.
And
it was a packed audience, it's packed out as well.
Mm.
We did an encore as well, where I just did an encore part of the piece as well. But I think that's one of the proudest moments of my whole career as a musician, to be honest. And I'm equally proud that it took place in a place. It happened in a place that was very, very dear to me, you know, which is, I guess that it really was. It added to the whole experience, I suppose, you know, because if it happened anywhere else, it would still be a great thing. But it was at the Band on the Wall, and it was for the Band on the Wall, you know.
Yeah.
It's for Steve.
Yeah.
But
that's nice.
It's a great thing, and I'm still grateful for the musicians. I mean, who made it happen?
Mm.
It was had a great brass set. Do you want to make a note of the musicians, or did you do it before?
Yeah. I think I got a vague note, but I'm recording too, so you tell me and I'll...
Yeah. Well, on trumpets, it was Dave Browning,
mm-hmm.
was a sort of legendary session trumpet player at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He played on the Coronation Street theme, David.
Okay.
Yeah, Richard Isles is a fantastic jazz trumpet player, still around now. French horn, or some French horn. Got my memory shot. Alan Toakley on French horn.
Mm-hmm.
Laurie Cooper on trombone and tuba.
Mm-hmm.
It was Chris Williams on lead alto. And I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the name of the second alto player. And Chris was playing flute and clarinet as well. It was Andy Scott on tenor sax and baritone sax.
Yeah.
And Jim Muirhead on baritone sax and bass clarinet. Myself on guitar and conducting. Dave Linnane on bass. Bloody hell, these are the people I've known all my life. Steve Gilbert on drums.
Okay.
And Andy Hickey on piano and keyboards. That was it. That was the band.
Yeah.
Wow. And then I don't know the names of the student band or the names of the people that that were in the gospel choir, but you could find out who used to organize. Chris Williams used to organize the student band, but I think actually that particular time he actually went off stage and up to the balcony and sort of helped them along with it. But I can't remember, as I say, it was 25 years ago. But
that was
a great band. I mean, it is a great band, and we did it on two rehearsals basically. Yeah. An hour long piece.
Yeah.
The day before and the afternoon of the performance.
That's crazy.
And then we repeated it at Christmas, around Christmas time as well.
Yeah.
And at that time I started teaching composition at Lipper in Liverpool. So I got some of my students to come down and play one of my other pieces.
Good.
So it's quite an interesting day.
Yeah.
And I get the bloody students under control. But if you're not completely sober when you do this gig, you want to look at what your grades are going to be.
but
it was an amazing experience. It really was, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm really honored to have done it. I mean, really am. Sadly that it was never recorded properly, so that's a shame, because I really wish you had a recording of it. It was done on a sort of archaic sort of system, and I think I've got one of the tapes around somewhere, but there's nowhere I can play it on anything.
Okay.
It's a shame, because it was a monumental, even historic occasion as far as the band and all was concerned.
I wonder if, I mean, it depends on how, like, obviously, hopefully nothing would happen to it, but if you wanted us to see if we had any software that could play it, any sort of like thing.
To be honest, Bertha, I don't even know where that is.
No, that's okay.
I've moved around so much since the last 25 years, even out of the country, you know, for 5 years.
Yeah.
That I'm not really sure where that is. I've got so many boxes of this and that, all over the place. If I ever come across it, but the thing is, it was one of those systems where you're required to play several different tapes at the same time.
Yeah.
The Betamax system, I think it was something like that. Mm-hmm. I think I've only got one of the tapes, which is not,
sure.
Wouldn't work with the rest of the tapes, you know.
Yeah, I see.
Which is a shame, you know, really is a shame, because I really would have liked to have some sort of memento of the occasion.
Well, I'm glad
that's in my... So say again.
I'm glad we've got that photo that you sent me. That was excellent.
Yeah, I'm also going to, I know I've got the letter from Ian Kroll somewhere about. And I've also got a review from the Manchester Evening News, which
is great. Yes, I'd like
to. Fantastic review from the Manchester Evening News, Chris Lee. And I've got that somewhere in a box, so I'll try and dig that out and send it to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's funny, Chris Lee, because he was always quite a big fan of mine, and he was writing really nice reviews about some of the things I've done.
Mm.
And I did, in the 80s, I got involved in theatre quite a lot, and I was a composer in residence for the Library Theatre Company in Manchester.
Yeah.
And I wrote the music for a production of a Christmas Carol,
okay.
Which Chris gave a terrible review of. Called the music Ineffectual Tinkling.
Oh no!
I was so pissed off with him, you know, and I hadn't seen him ever since then. And you know, he did write a great review for the Shouting on Swan Street and all that, and that was. That was years late. That was years later, you know. So
Yeah.
fair enough.
Not intellectual tinkling.
Fun enough, we got our own back on him because it was so popular, the show, that it was extended for another week, you know. But
Okay.
strangely enough, when I moved to Portugal, I was playing in a Dixieland band, and Chris turned up on holiday.
Really?
Yeah. It's really weird because I was looking across this guy in the audience while I was playing away, and I thought, I know him, you know, it's many years later. And of course, it turned out to be Chris, you know.
You were like, oh, you.
I mean, he was a bit of, he was a real friend to Manchester musicians,
yeah,
because he did lots of reviews,
yeah,
of gigs, you know, and he went to lots of gigs as well, you know. But I think he was always in the band on the wall reviewing stuff in there, you know. But yeah, so
yeah.
That's it, I think, you know.
I think, just lastly, just to make sure I covered everything, have you got any other memories, either as a performer or a punter, that you'd like to tell me about?
I think the most sensational gig I saw at the band was Hermeto Pascal, who died last week.
Okay.
You know, Brazilian musician. And that was just life enhancing. It was so fantastic. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I think any musician, anybody who was there on that night will say the same thing.
Mm.
And Hermeto died last week, you know, which is a great shame. I mean, he didn't even get mentioned in the national press. And this guy was a genius. He was an absolute genius. I saw Teddy Williams there once. She was obviously a legendary jazz pianist.
Yeah.
But I think Hermeto, it stands out, really.
Okay.
So many great gigs I went to, you know, and was part of as well, I think, as well. But that one particularly stands out in my memory as something which I'll never forget. It was just so amazing, really.
Life-enhancing, that's great to hear.
So again.
Life-enhancing is an excellent thing to come away from a gig. Feeling.
Well, it was, you know, I just never forgotten it, you know, all these years later, and that was, I can't remember how many years ago it was now. I mean, do you know Hermeto Pascal?
I'm not sure if I do, but I'll need to find out now.
Check him out. Yeah, I mean, yeah. He was a Brazilian guy. He was an albino.
Okay.
And he had always had a big long white beard, a huge mane of flowing white hair, and he was only a tiny guy as well. He just made music out of it, anything.
Okay.
If you gave him a glass, he'd make some music out of it, or
yeah,
a bottle, you know.
Wow.
Some of the things he's done, was one of his famous videos, his band standing in the river, stripped to the waist, and playing on bottles.
Wow, okay.
And, you know, just blowing on bottles to get different sounds.
Yeah.
You know, playing a wooden flute. But, I mean, he was just an incredible musician. He played so many instruments, a saxophone player, a flute player, piano player, a singer, a bandoneon player, a accordion player.
What a show.
So many instruments, and he played, I'm a percussionist, he played them all,
yeah, wow,
virtuoso standard as well, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was probably the best gig I've ever seen at the band on the wall.
Yeah.
For me, anyway, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Perfect. Well, thank you very, very much again.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to be part of it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's ingrained in my DNA, is the band on the wall. BOTB DNA.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. It's nice to have that shared DNA link.
Well, yeah, and I'm still totally amazed that 50 years later it's still going strong and bigger and better than ever, you know. Mm-hmm. I must come down and have a look around sometime, because I probably wouldn't recognise it now, but it was... But because you've got three stages now, is it three stages?
Got two stages, two.
Yeah.
One is very big. It's been extended. It's a 500 capacity venue now.
My God, that's amazing.
Yeah, and when they open it out so that the bar is closed and it's the venue and the bar, I think it's about 600 odd people.
Right,
yeah.
Because I mean, the original place was probably about 150.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always past the fire relations. It was always a couple of hundred people in there at least, you know. It's always like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, crikey, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And the pub next door, which
yes,
used to be called, because
Burton Arms.
Yeah, I should know it because I spent an awful lot of money in that place. As
I
few
think
musicians did.
there's the Rose and Monkey now, but and there's the Smithfield Arms, but before that I'm not too sure what they were called. I know there was the Burton Arms, but I'm actually not too
Yeah, it
familiar.
was the Burton Arms, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it was right next door to the Band on the Wall, wasn't it? Yeah, because we used to nip out. We used to drink at Band on the Wall, but probably nip out at the interval and have a drink there as well. One particular, I think I told you this before. There was a detective series on ITV called Bullman, and this particular episode involved a lot of musicians, jazz musicians, and I was in one of the bands that was supposed to be in the series, and they filmed it at the Band on the Wall. And we pre-recorded the music at Granada Studios the night before, and it was supposed to be late at night, but we actually started filming at about 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning,
Oh my goodness.
and they went round with smoke machines filling the whole place with smoke, so it looked like it's late night. And we were hanging around for ages before we got to do anything. And Dave Lanania was also on the gig. Got to about 10 o'clock and he said, "Oh, I bloody need a drink, man. You know, this is terrible." So there was nowhere open at this time. He said, "Yeah, the arms next door, you know." So I said, "It won't be open." And he said, "I'll get that bloody place open." So he went around and hammered on the door till somebody came to the door and said, "We're filming next door." He said, "We're dying of thirst. Let us in, let us in." And they did.
Excellent. Oh,
Now
that's really
it was about 10 o'clock in the morning, I had a few drinks, you know.
brilliant.
But yeah, it's a. Lots of things like that, and indeed, quite a lot of things were filmed at the band over the years. I think, you know, for TV programs, and so that I remember that one particularly. Because it's great, it actually used to be great doing mining gigs for television because there was no responsibility whatsoever because you already pre-recorded it. So you know, you could smash a few down and just pretend to be playing.
Excellent. I'm sure it made it more fun.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, we've done a few of those. Yeah, a few of those. I did one at for Granada TV. It's called what's it called? Oh, crikey, Liverpool. Oh, my memory's so bad now. But it's a great big swimming pool near Liverpool, on the coast. And that was all mimed, and we were supposedly playing with the Weather Girls, and it was all lots of different pop stars, but we were all miming to it. And the string section was from the Liverpool Philharmonic, New Brighton Rock, it was called. Yeah, and we were all miming away, but there was a free bar, so you can imagine what mayhem ensued, basically, because nobody had any responsibility whatsoever for them. For actually playing, because you know we were just miming away, and I was giving it the bass place. Unfortunately, my family viewed it on I think it was on Boxing Day, and I looked a total idiot, you know, giving it all that, and I wasn't actually playing anything at all. Really. It was just miming along to the track, you know. But
Oh,
those are
that's
great gigs,
funny.
though, because you know, responsibility and still the same payday. You know?
That's
Yeah.
funny.
Yeah, John Altman, who was the MD for that, many many years later, I contacted him through Facebook, and he said, "I remember you." He said, "You played bass on New Brighton Rock, didn't you?" And I was directing it. And I said, "Yeah, I did." He said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "You looked a bit out of it, didn't you?" I said, "Well, we always were out of it." It's funny because a few days later, I did a session at Chronology TV, and all the string players were there, and. I fetched up with my. I think I was playing guitar on that session. I can't remember now. So when I walked in, they're all going. I said, "What went wrong?" He said, "We're not telling you." Happy days, eh? Yeah. Anyway, that's great, Beth. I mean, thanks for inviting me to do this because it's nice to talk about something which is really sort of quite dear to me, really.
I'm really
And formed a lot of my informed and coloured a lot of my sort of life from that 70s right the way through to sort of 90s, I guess, you know, at least 20, well, 20, well, 20, the 25 years, I guess, you know. I mean, I haven't been in the place very much since then, I have to say, Mainly because I've moved around so much. I've not been in Manchester for many, many years now.
Say if you were able to come in on the 18th of October, there'll be all sorts going on. That'll be the day the archive event happens.
Right, 18th of October. Is it is that sort of all day thing, is it?
It's all day, yeah. We've
What
been on throughout the day.
day is that, you know?
It's a Saturday.
Saturday,
Yeah.
right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll try and make a point of getting there because I can get on the train and just get off at Victoria and just walk up, you know.
That'd be great to have you.
That would be fantastic, yeah. There's lots of bands and stuff on.
Yes. Apitos, actually.
Oh, Peter saw on, are they?
Yeah.
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 You know Dave Hassell's in hospital at the
You did
moment.
tell me, so I'm a bit worried about that. But I hope he's
Yeah, well,
okay.
I'm sure he'll be up and at him
Yeah.
for the 18th of
Yeah.
October because Dave is the most stoical person you're ever like to meet. He's had so many bad health issues. And I mean, if it was me, I'd just give up. But he just goes, yeah, that's all right.
Yeah.
He's having a pacemaker. Pacemaker, no problem. You know, no jokes about keeping time.
No.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be there on the 18th of
I hope
October.
so. Yeah, so
He
it's.
does, yeah, well, that would be great because I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
And a lot of the guys, I mean, there's Andy Scott, I'm sure will be on it,
Yeah, you will.
and Dale Gibson, I'm sure Dale Gibson and John Hinch, and Duncan Winfield on trombone. I think it was the usual guys that do it,
Yeah.
and Chris Manes on percussion, and probably Speedy Williams on bass, I think, or maybe David Lennon, I'm not sure, but
Definitely come down.
yeah, that would be
We
great. I'll try and
playing
get some.
today for
Is that
free.
an evening thing with it?
No, Apitos are actually playing during the day, and it's a free gig. And then in the bar there will be, I'm very aware that my laptop is on 2%, but basically in the bar will be Ollie, who is one of the duty managers here. He's an incredible musician. He's playing.
Right.
And Emma Taylor also works here, is also an excellent musician. She is singer, songwriter, lovely. And then in the evening, there's paid gig, and it's two bands that Gavin has booked. I think there's Children of Zeus and there's someone else. But yeah, it'll be a whole all-day big
Right.
party, hopefully.
Well, great. Well, if it's during the day, that'll suit me with the Pitos thing because I'm just getting back to Yorkshire, you know,
Sure.
basically. I have to get on the train, and
Yeah.
if you get on the late trains, I don't. Well, even the earliest trains, I don't get back till like 10 o'clock at night
Yes,
sometimes.
no, I don't.
I teach at Lipper in Liverpool, and I only go there one day a week now. But like on yesterday, I set off from the house at 20 to 7 and got home at 10 past 10. And
Yes,
that was
long
just
day.
with quite earlier trains. It takes 3.5 hours, you know.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
that would be great. I'll see if I
I'll
can
send
make
you an
that.
invite over. Yeah.
Just make a note of that.
Okay. So yeah. Thank you very, very much again.
Why not? My pleasure. Absolutely my
It's
pleasure.
my pleasure. It's an honor. Thank you very much.
Let me get something good out of this.
I definitely will. I already have. Yeah, it's been an excellent experience. Thank you. Okay.
Don't forget. If you haven't already talked to Munch Manship, you should try and get in touch with
I
him.
will. I will. Yeah.
Because he's played us so many times, you know. I mean, he's an old guy like me. He's not as old as me, but he was, when we first played together, he was about 22, I think, something like that, you
Okay.
know.
Yeah.
And now he's in his six, I think he's late 60s now, or might even be 70. I don't know
Yeah.
how old he is. I haven't seen him for a long time, you know.
Yeah, I'll definitely get in touch with
But
him.
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, well, that'll be
Yeah.
great.
Thank you very much.
So
Good to see you.
hopefully I'll come and, if I get down there, I'll come and search you out.
Yes, please do. I'll be around.
All right then.
Thank
Yeah.
you. See you later.
Bye for now then. Bye
Bye
bye.
bye.
Bye bye.